I'm Corey Beaumont-Flynn. Welcome to Beyond the Design, a show that gives you a peek behind the curtain of the design industry and shares the stories of those that are the driving force behind it. Well, welcome to Beyond the Design, and today we have with us Chandra Campbell, Frederico Ingo, and Glenda Flime from Butler Almsder Architects. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ray. Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You, Ray.
Absolutely. Well, I got all three of you, so I got a captive crowd today, which is great. Well, welcome. We're excited to have you on the show. Let's start with a brief introduction from each of you. Can you share a bit about your background and how you joined Butler Almsder Architects?
Yeah, I can start, Craig.
Perfect.
This is Chandra. I started at Butler Almsder in my early 20s. I actually got hired through a staffing agency. I was looking for a job to work while I was studying industrial design, and started out as the administrative assistant, and then within a year became the office manager while I was going to school. And once I graduated, I had to make a decision about whether or not I was going to stay at this firm that I'd come to love or go into my field of study. And the choice is obvious. I chose to stay. It was the best decision I made. I didn't feel ready to leave the firm, and I knew I had a lot more to learn from my boss and our mentor, Lewis Butler. So I stayed and was promoted to the CFO role, where stayed in that role for about 15 years until, sadly, Lewis Butler passed away in 2020 of esophageal cancer, and that's when I assumed the role of CEO.
Wow. So does 20 years ago seem just like yesterday?
So it's actually 25 years now.
Oh, 25 years. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It did go by very quickly, and this just feels like the firm is just an extension of my life now. It's just it's all integrated into one big, happy activity that I do every day.
It's kind of like a second family, I'm sure.
It is.
Well, Glenda, how about yourself?
Well, like Federico, I joined Butler Almsder 20 years ago. So not quite 25, but a long time ago. And I just never looked back. It was really the right shot for the type of project that I would done. Mm-hmm. I came to learn that residential was really where my passion lied, like creating this personal connection with people and creating kind of their home. Where they will really spend their most precious time was something that I really cherish and really gave me a lot of pleasure. And I really found like that's my passion. Right. I'm originally from Italy. I studied in Venice, and then I came to Berkeley for my master, and that's how I originally came to the Bay Area, and then just kind of never left.
Frederico, how about you?
So I'm the third member of the two-decade club here. So I'm like Glenda. I've been here 20 years as well, trying to catch up to Chandra. And it goes by very quick. Let's see. I came upon Butler Almsder. I think in 2004, kind of the early starts of their website, and just they did amazing work within kind of the single family residential realm, and submitted my portfolio and resume. There was a job opening that I think I saw in the AIASF website, and came in for an interview not knowing what to expect. I actually met with Lewis Butler for about half an hour. And maybe even less than half an hour, maybe 25 minutes. And I'm like, oh, that I can't tell if it went well or not. but it must have went okay, because I did get hired, and here we are 20 years later. And kind of like Glenda, I think recognize that my passion in architecture is doing residential work, and doing for the most part local residential work for clients that we get to know really well. Mm-hmm. And we get to kind of design and build for them. And I think one of the great things in addition to everything that Chandra and Glenda said, one thing that we're very good at is actually seeing our projects built. And I think that's, you know, just adds kind of a tremendous amount of richness to what we do, to our firm and to our clients' lives.
Well, your design approach combines modernist principles with a scientific method. How do you elaborate, or can you elaborate, on how this method influences your work and how it has shaped some of the notable projects that you've done for the firm?
Yeah, absolutely. And great question, Craig. Thanks. So I actually stumbled into the kind of the scientific method approach when trying to describe what I do to my parents. So both of my parents are microbiologists. So I was like, they were really curious as to, you know, how do I, you know, look at design and come up with ideas? And it kind of allowed me a language to talk to them about it. And it really kind of stuck with me in terms of, you know, approaching a project without too many preconceived ideas, but really, you know, sitting down with a client or if I could be romantic, with a site, and understanding, you know, what, you know, being curious, understanding what are the issues, what are the questions I should be asking, what is, you know, the goal of the project, whether it's the client's goal, or really what does the project want to be, and kind of putting a rigor and a process to kind of this information gathering, and then developing ideas from there. So putting, again, kind of a process to it. And I do think it's a rigorous project, but there's a looseness to it as well. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that, you know, in general, I approach most projects by getting to know the client, really understanding what they're trying to accomplish, their goals, trying to understand, you know, what are the site constraints, the challenges, the opportunities available on a site. And then also technical information, whether it might be code related information such as setbacks, height restrictions. We do have to design to things like that. So it's always important to know all that, from the start. And in sometimes kind of, you know, gathering all that information until you put kind of pen to paper and really start to develop ideas and trying to synthesize everything in there. But once you put pen to paper, you know, it's good to test lots of theories. There's no reason that the first thing that you put down on paper is going to be the mm-hmm. best one. And sometimes it takes, you know, putting down dozens of ideas or hundreds of ideas down on paper and really analyzing them, getting feedback from different people, getting, and we'll go into this, I'm sure, as we go through the podcast in terms of, you know, how we work with our teams and developing those ideas. But it's, you know, it's, I think, you know, I want to combine rigor with looseness, and process all at once if I can. I hope I answered some of that
yes.
question.
It's not a test. We just go with it. Glenda,
good.
I mean,
Glenda,
being from Italy, you know, the epitome of classical design, how does your design sensibilities are deeply influenced by your Italian upbringing and your family's lineage of builders? How do you use these influences to manifest your projects? And share some examples to us.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about like the Italian upbringing and the kind of like this classical, you know, I feel like there's some classical principle to architecture that are mm-hmm. universal. Like there's proportion, there is light, there's building that, you know, were built, you know, hundreds of years ago, if not like thousands of years ago, and we right. all common, like it is known from everyone that those buildings have something special, and there is I feel like values that we put no matter what our cultural background, whatever our upbringing is, whatever social economic, whatever any of that is kind of in a way irrelevant. It's almost like there is kind of this really basic qualities that we values. And I think there's always a strive to try to capture those one in a project. And I think really when you think of a space, when you start like on the side to down to the minuscule detail, those ideas really come to place, like the proportion, the lights, the texture, how those all interact to each other are really what is kind of guiding the process. Mm-hmm. And I think from the lineage of builder comes like really where how are all these principles actually becoming reality? How do they actually really come together? What is that detail? What is that intersection between one material and another material? How do you really are deliberate with that and think about it versus just letting them happen? You know, there's like the dean of my school in Venice in Italy was Carlo Scarpa. So I always think about like, how would he have thought of, you know, putting something together? How would these two materials coming together? How would these two shapes come together? So there's always an inspiration there. And then I think the context is always a very big presence for me. It's like it means different things depending on what type of project. If it's a new building or if it's a remodel, it really kind of determines it's different what context means. Like, so if it's a remodel or if it's something that is in the urban environment, you always relate to what are the building, you know, what is the neighborhood? What are the building next to you? How is that informing? But at the same time, when you're kind of like, you know, in California, you have like so many beautiful sites that are untouched, then that context become like the hills or the coast or the mountains. So there's always an inspiration there and there's always a presence that I think we have to honor and really take into consideration, because in a way that context is the one that is going to stay there. It was there before the building and it's probably going to be there after the building.
So Federico, gathering information and listening to a client is an important factor in design and projects. Right. How do you translate that information into a design vision that aligns with your client's needs and preferences?
And another great question, Cray. Let's see. And, you know, again, it's kind of a process of kind of trial and error and, you know, taking that information and putting it down on paper. Kind of, I think in the first part, we really talked about kind of the process. This second question is, you know, how to make sure that we translate that information successfully to a client. Kind of thinking of a very recent meeting, I just had a kickoff meeting for a new project here in the peninsula. And first meeting was walking through the site with a client and kind of getting an understanding of, you know, again, the design opportunities on the site, where there's more sun, where there's view, where there's privacy issues. And then this second meeting was here in the office, and it was really just putting down pen and paper. We presented a handful of schemes that addressed that, and were able to kind of in a number of ways, which includes, you know, floor plans, renderings, and 3Ds, also inspiration images, be able to not only show them that, okay, we're essentially checking the boxes of these things, these requirements for the site, requirements for the program, but really kind of also in a somewhat poetic way, like telling, you know, a story and a way for them to live. And what they thought, you know, they really had it in their head, for example, and this is where, you know, I want to say that I listen, but I don't, you know, and most architects are good listeners, but they don't always do exactly what they're told. And
they're also creative. So
they're also creative. And I think you have to listen kind of at what the intent is and not what the directive is. And the client really had in their head that they wanted a courtyard house, so that they could, you know, have the privacy in this central courtyard. And We presented, you know, their preferred scheme, but we also presented a couple other, I want to say, kind of interpretations of courtyard schemes, where it's not your traditional center courtyard, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, a front courtyard that then captures, you know, part of the main house, the great room, as part of the courtyard as well, and then travels to the backyard. So suddenly, instead of one kind of central space, we're capturing, you know, three spaces, a front courtyard, the great room, and the backyard. And so I think kind of explaining that through these different ways of, you know, graphic representations, whether it's floor plans or 3Ds, showing that and conveying the intent, is, you know, usually how we get an alignment between, you know, all these factors of, mm-hmm. you know, what they want, how they want to live, what the site can afford. It's a fun and exciting process.
So Sandra, not to leave you out, as the CEO, how do you ensure that the firm's projects maintain a high level of quality and design integrity from start to finish?
Yeah, when Glenda and Federico and I took over the firm, we spent a lot of time on thinking what was important to us as the three new leaders of the firm. We came up with core values that spell DEPTH, which is design, excellence, people, trust, and honesty. So the design and excellence is at the forefront of all of our decisions when we're thinking about how to approach a new project. And we all feel deeply invested in those values. So we've put together processes and procedures that hold us accountable to the goals of design excellence. So we have committees that review technical details. We do design charrettes that involve the whole office. And we do have smaller kind of peer reviews of our projects before we present them to clients so that we've thought through all of the details and know that we have the best design options available to present to our clients. And we just really feel that design is at the forefront of everything we do. And the depth of that process is something that we feel passionate about.
So Federico, your Lagoon House and Cow Hollow Townhouse have been widely recognized. Can you tell us about the design challenges you faced with these projects and how you overcame them?
Absolutely. And two very different projects. I'm glad you chose these. Going back to a comment Glenda made in terms of a lot of the work we do, we could talk about percentages, but, you know, we do a lot of, especially here in San Francisco, where there's a lot of existing housing stock, we do a lot of renovations, reconstructions of projects. So the Cow Hollow Townhouse was an example of that type of project where it was essentially a reconstruction, renovation addition to an existing kind of typical row house here in San Francisco. And our client was in a wonderful East Coast kind of transplant, or actually from the West Coast, lived in the East Coast for a long time, and brought her New York kind of aesthetic with her back to the Bay Area, which I thought was a wonderful combination. And this project had two real challenges. One is that it's an upside down house, so the public spaces are on the top floor to really take advantage of the bay views. Mm-hmm. As well as much more open space and light and air. And then the bedroom levels are below. And then what to do with the front facade. And we wanted to do, you know, something interesting and also something that, you know, reflected our client's East Coast aesthetic. And again, through the process of exploration and questioning and going through different ideas, you know, said, you know, San Francisco, in addition to having this rich history and legacy of Victorian houses, which for the most part are painted wood, it does have a few iconic stone buildings. And we said, wow, this is a great opportunity to highlight not only our client's East Coast aesthetic, but also celebrate a little bit of what San Francisco was actually in, you know, the late 1800s with this, these iconic stone buildings. So the front facade, we clad it in basalt stone, and we added, again, through the process of sampling and testing, you know, we wanted to really do something that was unique to San Francisco, and again, kind of adding a romantic spin and story to the front facade. We felt like the it's a raked basalt, and it really kind of, you know, told the story of the place, which is Cow Hollow, which is right on the edge of the North Bay or of the Bay. And that's where the fog comes in. Oftentimes the fog is low and just kind of covers, you know,
just sits there,
comes right under the Golden Gate. And so we said, wow, you know, we really think this reiki pattern, you know, talks to that, you know, that fog, and, in some ways echoes it, in a building material, which we thought was kind of a fantastic story. On the Lagoon House, I'm going to be quick because, I can talk for hours about these. but I know, there's a lot to say on the Lagoon House. A great kind of very interesting design challenge, lots of factors, but, that we synthesized. Two of the main factors were it's a double lot. So how to really maximize the use of a house, on this double lot. At the same time, floor areas are very limited in this area of Marin because of septic requirements. So the house itself had to be small. So how do we create, you know, a feeling of largeness on this unique double lot, but while being very mindful of the floor area restrictions? And at the same time, because of privacy issues, the house could not open directly to the lagoon. It actually had to open kind of diagonally so that we could see the long part of the lagoon as opposed to looking directly at the neighbor right across the lagoon. So kind of synthesizing all that information, and again, through testing a few different options, we came across this L-shaped scheme with a large courtyard that really focused the view to the long part of the lagoon and really maximize the use and the area of the entire lot, and not thinking of just the house and the courtyard as separate spaces, but thinking of that as one continuous space. So suddenly we turned really, you know, a house that has about 3,000 square feet into, you know, this area that takes advantage of the majority of this double lot.
I mean, I could ask all of you about all your projects, but we're only an hour show. So
yes.
Now, Glenda, your Valley of the Moon retreat has won several awards. What was the inspiration behind this project, and how did you achieve the balance between the built environment and the natural landscape?
So that project is a very interesting project. One's because it did win a lot of awards, but also because it, you know, it went through one really large fire in 2017, kind of right after it was finished, like about a couple of years after it was finished. And what makes it really special, it sits on a very large parcel of about like almost 40 acres, of which, 90% is actually a conservation easement, so nothing could ever be built on it. And there are paths that go through that, you know, that people can take to explore the nature. And so it was really about having a really light touch, and how can we make something that is compact and as light on nature as possible. I talked earlier about the context and just kind of really taking that into consideration, and also finding a place where we could really minimize how much kind of grading, how much earth movement we could do. once we found that, we really landed on kind of a scheme that was very compact, set on a plinth, and had a kind of maybe a lot of, like a reminiscent of a early hacienda in California, kind of like something that is sitting in the, you know, in the between the oaks, is open to it, but at the same time kind of protected. And mm-hmm. it was also very interesting that the plinth and the compactness of the floor plan, as well as we think the metal roof, were kind of the factors that made this building survive the fires. Many of the buildings that are around in that valley, like, all burned down. So it was kind of an interesting, in a way, when we designed and thought about this building, we were not as much aware of the fireproofing as much as we are these days, but really there's some kind of tried and truth. What I was saying before, like going back to maybe like some of the earlier teachings and, mm-hmm. and the fact of like how building were designed, how they actually in a way, you know, perform very well, even in this kind of extremes events. So it was really this balance of like being light on the environment and being compacted, but at the same time being really kind of able to take advantage of it.
Fantastic. Now, given the amount of awards, how many awards has the firm overall won for some of the work it's completed and done over the years? Do you know offhand, Chandra?
You know, I wish I knew that number offhand. I think I need to go look it up.
It's a good number to have off the top of your sleeve here.
I'm sorry, I don't have that number to give to you.
No worries.
I'm not sure. We've been in business for 40 years. And I think I'm going to guess that maybe there's at least a dozen awards that we've received, if not more. I think I might be on the conservative side.
So, Chandra, you've been instrumental in running the Lewis W. Butler Foundation. How does this role complement your work at Butler Armstrong Architects?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. It's it's work I'm really proud of. We started the foundation to honor Lewis and after his passing, and it was really to pick up on his mission to better the lives of young people. He really believed in the power of education. He was involved in programs like Summer Bridge, which is a program here that San Francisco University High School runs that brings public school students to a private school and kind of gives them scholarships. And so he was very involved in that, as well as the Sandcastle Contest, which brings art and architecture to public schools. So just adopting his mission to bring education to students who might not have the means to do that on their own. We provide scholarships, mentorships, and internships to students who are interested in design, whether that's architecture, industrial design, graphic design, and illustration. And our mission is to support them through all 4 years of their college or whenever they come to us. And that really, yeah, we're really excited. We've issued 20 scholarships so far. And again, we provide mentorship and internship throughout that experience for them. And yeah, we're really proud of that. It supports not only, Lewis's mission, but also our firm's mission, which, is to increase the diversity in the field of architecture. Specifically, we're 68% women and have been 68% or so for probably 15 years. And so that's something that's really ingrained in our office culture, that we want to promote not only that diversity, but general diversity through our DEI committee and just representation in the firm. I find it really fulfilling, and it's been really great to see what these students are producing, and we're excited to see where they are in 4+ years from now.
Or maybe even 25.
Yeah, 25, yes.
They may never leave.
It goes
that's
by
okay
quick.
With us. Clearly, that's okay with us.
Yeah. You three have set the precedent, so.
Yes.
So, Frederico, how does sustainability factor in your projects at Butler Armsden, and what steps do you take to ensure environmentally friendly designs?
Great question. I always keep a couple kind of facts kind of at the top of my mind in terms of what we do and our kind of, you know, need as architects and the industry being sustainability minded. And that is that I think 40% of greenhouse emissions come from construction. You know, and so every time we, you know, build a home or remodel a home, we're contributing to that greenhouse percentage. Another one is about 20% of energy use in the U.S. Is dedicated to residential use. So again, our homes require a huge amount of energy, right, just for their upkeep. And then the other one, which is changing a little bit, but the average home size right now in the U.S. For new homes is about 2,300 square feet. It reached its peak of 2,500 square feet a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But if you compare that to historical numbers, and I'm not going to go back too far, but in the 70s and 80s, the average home size was about 1,500, 1,600 square feet. So in general, our homes have gotten larger. And I think it's, you know, kind of our jobs as architects and designers and builders and being in the industry to really kind of, you know, highlight that, and, you know, see how we can offset that, those numbers quite, you know, as much as possible. And I want to say that, you know, most of our homes are larger than 2,300 square feet. Mm-hmm. So even more so, it's, you know, it's necessary for us to incorporate, you know, the highest level of systems for lower energy use. And that can be anything from window systems to actual mechanical systems. We have, and it's in kind of an increasing feature, but we have completed a couple all electric homes and kind of see that trend growing more and more as there's, you know, kind of cleaner capabilities for electric use. Mm-hmm. And also, so, you know, again, just the understanding of, you know, what are the circumstances of the building industry and how we can offset that. And then finally, thinking of our projects as, you know, projects and homes that are going to have as long a life as possible. So making sure that things are built for today's standards, but also for future standards. And that could be everything from structural, mechanical systems to like the quality of the construction and the quality of the materials. Just so that in, you know, hopefully in 10 years, 20 years, you know, that, and maybe even longer, 50, 100 years, the house is still functioning the way it should, and it's not being torn down or substantially remodeled for the next homeowner.
So, Glenda, almost the same question to you, but in a different way. You've been pivotal in establishing Butler Armsden's interior design department. How do you integrate sustainable practices into interior design, and why is it important?
Well, I think it's important. It kind of like answers itself. I think, you know, we have a big problem of like landfill, and, you know, even what we think is recycled, it is not really getting exactly recycled. So right. I think in that vein, thinking about like reuse is probably the most impactful and important practice. we work with a lot of our clients reusing their pieces and being like them, being pieces that they bought and have a sentimental value to them, family heirlooms. But also, if we do end up, you know, adding to their furniture, is really thinking of it as something that can withstand the test of time. So kind of something that is timeless and something that is built, very well built. Or we can buy some vintage pieces so that we could keep those out of the landfill. So I think a combination of really all of that. And in the kind of something that tests, you know, the withstand the test of time, like working with some local, some talented local craftsmen. We have many of them here in the Bay Area, and really kind of have these pieces that are, that people feel like they can actually pass down to their kids. It's something that is really important. I think you mentioned something about like having your own line of furniture, and I'm sure you think a lot about this and what, who builds it, how gets it built, especially in this era right now of like this really kind of fast fashion and trends and all wants to be like talking a lot about that. And I feel like it's such a, I don't know. It feels like the wrong approach. I almost think of furniture the same way I think of architecture, of something that really has a permanence to it versus something that is disposable. And then I think that really that layering of like new pieces, pieces that are heirlooms, pieces that you found traveling, they do really add an amazing feel of specialness to a space. So it kind of, in a way, all converges.
So Glenda and Federico, I have almost the same question for both of you. Does Butler Armsden have a aesthetic signature that you incorporate into each project, or is a hidden component of each project?
That's a fun question.
you can answer too, Chandra.
Yeah, no, Chandra, please. You can answer as well.
it's for all three of us.
I can go first.
Yeah, why don't you start us off, Glenda?
I think anyone that has either come to our office, we have a wall with all kind of photographs of all our projects, or have looked at our website or our Instagram, kind of see that we don't have a very specific signature style, as far as we always have this type of element. But I think it is a very deliberate choice. We think, as Federico mentioned, and I mentioned, and Chandra in her mentioned as well, is it is really an approach that takes into consideration the context, the clients. Like, all this is really what is informing. It's not like a pure aesthetic. We don't believe that there is one aesthetic that will feel, that will fit all contexts, or all the constraints that are given to us, or all the opportunity that are given to us. And at the same time, we feel that there is a really high level of excellence, both in the overall design, the layouts, but also down to the smallest detail, that is really what connects all our projects.
And if I could jump in there and definitely echo everything Glenda said, I would say not only an excellence that kind of connects, you know, the say the big picture of a project down to the small details. But I think two other words always resonate with me. One is intentionality, and thinking of every project as intentional and thoughtful for that context and client. And I love it when, you know, either clients or people recognize how that uniqueness is deliberate. And then the other one is a sense of timelessness. I also always think that, you know, and more so, I think our projects hopefully are striving to be timeless. Again, not only from a sustainability standpoint that we talked about, but in terms of, you know, just a feeling. And I think that that also comes through with the intentionality of the materials, the excellence of the detailing. And it means sometimes that actually, I'd love to share a little bit more of another project coming up. But we've stripped, this project down to almost its essence, and maybe more than stripped, really synthesized things down to a very simple, in a way, material palette that I think will, work for the site and for this particular client, but also feels very appropriate for the overall context of the project as well.
Chandra?
Yeah, I would just add that I think one thing that our projects have in common is that we have, through the years of experience, we have a depth of a pool of craftspeople that we work with. And so hiring the best team to execute our vision is a big part of what we do. So we work with contractors who really understand how to put together the materials that we're specifying and really create a fine product that they can realize the vision that in our drawings.
Fantastic. So it's all cohesive and all comes
yes.
together. So being the longest there, Chandra, how has mm-hmm. your background influenced your leadership style and approach to managing the firm as the CEO, given your journey of 25 years at the firm?
Yeah. So I would say that one thing from my early beginnings is that my parents are both entrepreneurs, and I've always been around people, my parents running their own business. My dad had a tech company in the early 90s. So computers were always a part of my life before even they were kind of mainstream. And my mom had a catering company, and clearly the labor laws were different then, because at 12 years old, I was a little tiny server out there passing out hors d'oeuvres. So I've always had a really strong work ethic. And whatever I do, I'm all in. If I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And that has led me to positions where I've gained trust quickly and have ended up in management positions in most of my roles that I've worked in from, let's say, 12 on. So that's been really helpful in just my approach to what I do here and how I've grown through the firm. I love challenging myself to grow and learn, and that's something that we encourage and promote in our staff as well. We implemented a professional development series this year where the entire staff will take half a day and participate in topics like communication. We did the strength finders, conflict resolution, mentorship, and time management. We're really trying to develop the whole person. And interestingly, my leadership style, I think, is kind of fully my own through the strength finders and through other assessments I've taken. Empathy always comes up as my number one trait. Really? And I'd say, yes, I'd say maybe in past times that empathy might not be seen as a powerful or even helpful leadership trait. But for me, it's been really great and has served me well in times of great change and transition. And I believe deeply in caring for others and use that as a guiding principle when I'm faced with challenges and decisions I need to make. Balanced by my pragmatic approach to business and finance, which from my long career. So it's served me well.
Fantastic. I think empathy is a strong character trait. It's a sense of understanding, and you're
Thank
listening
you.
To others. Yeah. So Federico and Glenda, how do you foster a collaborative environment within the firm, and what strategies do you use to mentor younger architects, designers, and new mentors or interns coming into the firm?
Glenda, do you want me to jump in here?
Yeah.
Perfect. So let's see. I think a lot to try to cover in this one, because, the architectural field and design field is so nuanced and deep that, you know, it's a long mentoring strategy. But I think I want to start with, you know, coming out of the pandemic, and we were one of the first offices that actually felt it was very important to get back to the office and come together as a team and, you know, as a larger team to maintain that Butler Armstrong and culture that we're so proud of, but also kind of as individual teams. And we're a group of, you know, 25, 30 super talented designers, architects, and, you know, have an open office. And I think there's so much value in terms of just learning from each other, learning from conversations from different, you know, problems that might arise and how those problems are being handled or solved, whether it's technical issues, something as, you know, window systems or permits, or how, you know, how do you go about, you know, designing a bathroom or a new house? You know, these are all great design problems at different levels. So I think we have just kind of an openness and a culture of openness and information sharing that I'm very proud of here in the office. And I think, you know, individually, I think of kind of my role in terms of, you know, creating opportunities and creating kind of space for somebody's voice to come through on a team or on an individual basis. And then also, I want to say, you know, after 20 years here at Butler Armstrong and 4 years at a previous firm, so almost going on 25 years, you know, there's a lot of stories that I love to share. And I think of mentorship and architecture in particular as, you know, kind of passing on that apprenticeship kind of role and sharing stories of past projects or situations and how that those can apply. And I feel like that's how I learned from Lewis and from my previous employer, Chad. In terms of, you know, how they would share their previous history. And, you know, sometimes it's very obvious how you apply it to a situation. And sometimes it's just a catalog of experiences that you save up and you have to figure out how and when to apply it.
True, true. Glenda, and for you, collaborative environment?
Well, okay. Federico mentioned it and Chandra mentioned it, I think, at the beginning of the podcast. Like, you know, we have this very open kind of environment where everybody chime in, but also like we have like these committees and pinups and things like that, that really like want to make sure that even if you're not on the project, there is kind of a participation and you're kind of aware of what is going on and you can comment because, you know, sometimes just from the outside, sometimes you know, when you've been on that, trying to find that solution for, you know, a week or longer, you know, you lose perspective. And so it's always very refreshing to just kind of see other point of views. So I think what we really try to foster that. And then on the mentoring, I think, you know, being passionate, having a really high level of integrity and just kind of and keep pushing the envelope, I think are really traits that kind of guides my decisions. And also remember that even though, as Federico said, we've been doing it for a very long time, for decades, no one ever, and you know, you're never done learning. Learning is a forever process. And sure. So kind of infuse them all in every interaction, even if it is a more formal kind of mentoring session, or maybe it's just a quick sit down to look over a sketch, like just kind of really bringing those principles and that energy to them, I think is, and reinforce them.
I would add, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Chandra.
I was just going to say, I would add to that a big part of our firm culture is to do one-to-ones or check-ins with our staff at least monthly. and really kind of stay close to what they're working on, what their challenges are, and building building on skills that they need, or finding what areas they need additional development or support in. That's really important to us, and it's a process that is integrated into our firm.
Fantastic. Chandra, looking back at your career with Butler Armstrong, what are you most proud of, and what do you envision for the future for the firm for the next 25 years?
Lots to be proud of. I have to say that my biggest thing I'm proud of is that I can say that Butler Armstrong is a firm where the administrative assistant can become the CEO. I believe that if you're a driven person, there's nothing you can't accomplish at our firm. It's highly unusual that the CEO of an architecture firm is not an architect herself. But we see that as a real strength for our firm. It's that I can focus on the business, which I'm passionate about, and Glenda and Federico can focus on design, which they're passionate about. And so it's a win-win all the way around. In the future, I'm envisioning similar paths for our staff that feel that they have a passion for organization and leadership, and someday they can assume our roles and perpetuate the legacy of beautiful homes and architecture in the Bay Area and beyond. I think we're shaping both futures and landscapes.
Fantastic. So Federico and Glenda, I have a question for the both of you. What upcoming projects are you most excited about, and what previous projects are you most, most proud of? And what impact do you hope that they will have on the community and just the design architectural field in general? Glenda, you want to go?
Yeah, I can go. I'm going to start with the... it's a hard question. I'm going to start with the proud of, just because it's maybe fresh on my mind. Ended up yesterday going to a concert at a client's house, and it was actually a client that we originally designed their penthouse in the mid-90s, early 90s. And then 25 years later, they came and said, hey, you know, we're ready for redesigning this for the next 25 years. And in those 25 years, they were always passionate about music, but when it is, you know, they became really involved in the music scene, and they really wanted to have a space in their home where they could hold a concert, like, I mean, of very notable, you know, musicians, like Yo-Yo Ma played at their house, like, you know, very, very impressive. And, but, you know, so the brief was, we want to be able to use, to have chamber music, concert, piano concert, for up to 50 people in a house. And how can you reconfigure that in a high rise on a penthouse? So with all those constraints and working with the, you know, acoustical engineers and all of, I mean, we, to the point that, you know, when they moved in, we had actually the quartet come in to focus the lights. So to make sure that those lights were kind of perfectly set. And it was such an amazing experience to be there last night and just kind of see that really coming to fruition, and seeing like really this amazing musician playing in the space, seeing the people using the space, and how amazing the sound was. It was just kind of really a really proud moment. And of the project that I am most excited about is one that is currently under construction, is a ground up here in San Francisco. It's actually an unusually large lot. It's almost like half an acre. So it's an urban project, but more of a project that we ended up siting the house. Usually when you have an urban project, you're like, okay, you have a front setback, you have a side setback, and this is kind of like, you have a lot of constraints, and the box kind of, it identifies itself. And in this case, it was like, how do you apply this principle of something that you will build in a larger plot of land, but in an urban environment? And what are the factors that come to play? Right. So kind of seeing that one coming to life, and it's kind of something that is a project that you can actually see from the Golden Gate Bridge and the way kind of changing the skyline of the city from that on that part of the city is kind of something that is interesting and I'm really looking forward to.
I'll have to look for it. And I didn't get a phone call last night to go with the concert with you, so I'm a little upset there.
It must have got lost in the mail, Craig.
They were playing side by side to analyze the differences. It was pretty unbelievable.
I bet.
And don't feel bad, Craig. We didn't get a phone call either.
Uh-oh. Someone's in trouble.
I know.
So Federico, how about you? What are you most excited about in any upcoming projects, and what are you most proud of a past previous project?
I could probably take an hour to answer this one, but I'm going to try to keep it quick. Very similar to Glenda, I think what I'm most proud of is a project that we just photographed very recently, about 2-3 weeks ago. And it's a beach house on the Marin coast also. And it's small. It's about 2,000 square feet, one story. And with a photographer, we did some prep leading up to the photo shoot. So he understood kind of our goals. Mm-hmm. And he asked, what was the client's mandate for the project? I thought about it, and a couple words that came back to me from an early conversation was, and they had seen our work before, so they kind of knew what we could do, but they said, we want a modern, unpretentious beach house. And I said that to Joe, and he just, his eyes kind of opened up, and he's like, wow, I think you did that. So I thought, the fact that, again, a very simple concept, that started with, just a few words 5 years ago or 4 years ago, mm-hmm. was conveyed, through the project, to the photographer's eyes. I thought that was an example of a successful, process.
And I'm gonna interject in, because they were actually at the concert, the clients, yesterday, and they said that they actually cannot believe that that's their house. And every time they go there, they pinch themselves and they're like, this is such a dream come true. And it is everything we wanted and more. So Federico,
there's nothing better than that.
Exactly. It's just in the eyes of the photographer.
No, that's great. But it does go to, kind of where we started in terms of giving the client what they want, but also hopefully a lot more. And maybe things that they didn't know that they wanted as well.
True.
And sometimes that comes in a big package. And again, this one comes in a small package of 2,000 square feet.
Chandra, since taking the reins, how do you see Lewis's legacy living on besides the foundation? And what would you think of his thoughts today of some of the projects moving forward?
I think he would be really excited about the projects that we have right now moving forward. We have more ground up new construction projects than we've had at one time, probably ever in history. So, and that was something that he was really excited about, because you get to design the entire house. It's fun to have the constraints of a remodel as well, but mm-hmm. being able to really create something that has an impact on the neighborhood, and is something that's going to be there for a long time. I think he'd be really excited about that. His legacy is living on in every person that works here that has worked with him and has now worked with Glenda and Federico and I, in his vision for fantastic design and having fun doing it. We really try to infuse some fun into the office and have people enjoy being here and creating great work.
I mean, I think that's a legacy for all three of you. I mean, 20 years is a long time, and that's very unusual for, especially in our industry, for people to stay around that long. So obviously he set the standard and has the culture that people want to stay, which is fantastic. Yes. And congrats to all of you for experiencing that with him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been wonderful having all of you on the show. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about Butler Armstrong Architects or upcoming projects or what's next for you and the firm? Oh, Chandra, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. let's see. As coming up, I would say, again, the new ground up construction projects. That's something to look out for. We are currently photographing a lot of work that we finished from pandemic and before. So we're going to be pitching that. So hopefully you're going to see some of our work in publication soon. So I would say go to our Instagram and follow along. And while you're there, check out our viral garage door video that has 3.5 million views.
Wow.
That was a special moment for us recently. That's pretty fun to see.
Fantastic. Federico?
Everything Chandra just said, I'm, you know, super excited about all our current projects and our fantastic staff working alongside with us and on those projects, and really can't wait to see those. You know, I think in terms of what's next, I always, you know, we always get the question as architects, you know, what's architecture going to look like in 10, 20, 30 years. Right. And I always say I can't answer that. I can tell you what it looked like. Maybe, you know, using Glenda's heritage, you know, back to the Italian Renaissance, right. Or what we're currently doing it right now. But I think, again, I can't tell you what it's going to look like, but I think if we continue kind of on our trajectory and, you know, with the staff and the systems and the talent and the curiosity that we have in place, it's going to be an exciting thing to look forward to.
And Glenda?
And I think, you know, we all collectively look forward to, you know, we have a lot of staff that has worked. We are here for 20 plus years, but we have also had a lot of staff that has been with us for, you know, over a decade. So for kind of half of that journey or longer, and just kind of keep collaborating with them and not only with them, but with also with our clients. Now we have clients that have worked with us, as I was mentioning earlier, mm-hmm. like for, you know, 20 or plus years. And, you know, I'm just going, like, next week, I'm going to go to Aspen with a client that, you know, I did my first interior project. I did my first architectural plus interior project for them. And their kids were going, like, one was in kindergarten, one was in second grade, one was in third grade. And now they're all graduated from college and kind of like seeing that evolution, and not only of our firm, but of our clients. And how can we keep this relationship going? It's just very, you know, it's what I'm looking forward to in the future. More of that.
That says a lot to have that legacy and that continuing development of not just a client, but trust and respect that they keep coming back. That's something to be very proud of, especially in this industry.
Another, not just repeat clients, but we get repeat homes too. So somebody will sell the house and they'll call us to do a remodel on that same house, say 20 years later. And that's really fun too.
Absolutely.
It's true. I'm doing one right now that won the AIA award right before I actually joined Butler Armstrong, and now we're kind of redoing it for the same family. So it's very interesting and it's kind of fun.
Right. Because then you can go back and say, well, why did I do it that way? And then it's like an evolution of your own career, in essence.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, thank you again, Chandra, I'm sorry.
You had it right, Chandra.
Federico, it's been
an extreme
pleasure. I have some new friends, and I will keep track of you. And again, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us, Craig.
All right, we'll
have
you soon.
A real pleasure.
Thank you.
for tuning in to Beyond the Design. Subscribe for more inspiring conversations to our YouTube channel. Follow us on social media for updates and behind-the-scenes content. See you next time.
Hi, you're listening to a Pod for Good Media Network podcast. We are a network that provides podcasting production services and a supportive community in which podcasters can thrive. If you're a podcaster local in the Tulsa area, we would love to have your show on the network. If you are interested in starting one, we would love to help you get started. Find us online at podforgoodmedia.com and fill out our Pod With Us form. Happy podcasting!